Jane Cascadia. Today is Friday, March 12th, 2010, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. And this is their Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
In the Klamath Basin, when the farming gets weird, farmers get insured.
Oregonians are starting to ask the biomass industry just what it means when it calls itself sustainable.
And a Trey Arrow, activist who's put his life on the line for his beliefs, is back with us today with some music to inspire those of us active in any form of a movement towards a better world.
Portland area weather today, showers with a moderate south wind, high near 52. Tonight, more showers, low around 40. And then partly sunny for a couple of days before the rain returns on Tuesday.
And first we have some news from around Cascadia. Yesterday, on a local, very popular program on public radio, there was a discussion of LNG. There were voices that were not heard and questions that were not asked. Joining us today, my guest is Jody McCaffrey, anti-LNG activist from Coos Bay, with an update on the LNG situation down south regarding the Jordan Cove project. Good morning, Jody. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So can you bring listeners, we haven't spoken to you for a while. There is, of course, this project proposed for Jordan Cove. Right now, it seems that when a program that is heard virtually statewide takes notice of the LNG situation, that everyone is beginning to open their eyes and take a look at what we're faced with. Can you talk a little bit about the situation there?
In Coos Bay or just...
In Coos Bay.
Well, right now we're like in a holding pattern. We're waiting for FERC. They, of course, approved the project. We filed a request for rehearing, and then they asked for an extension to come back and make the decision whether they will relook at our project or not. And I think right now there's a bill Senator Wyden has at the federal level to get the decision back in the hands of the state, which is actually really a good thing. And I think the industry must be worried. That's why they're having other shows, you know, try to get their message out. But the big problem with FERC is that they are made up of political, a lot of the head positions at FERC are political appointees. They're not people that have actually had degrees and are looking at this stuff. So you're having your decisions in the hands of people that probably, you know, can be swayed and not, maybe the decisions aren't in the best interest of the environment or other issues.
They may be beholden to the energy industry, and of course
right.
There's the lobbyist, as we always have to contend with. What's the next step for you down there in Coos Bay?
Well, as soon as FERC makes their decision whether they're going to look at our issues, which we don't know how that will go, there is a new member of the FERC commission that has come on board. We don't know what their position is exactly. We expect FERC just to rubber stamp it like they've done other things, so then we will have to file an appeal just like the Bradwood Landing fight has gone. Then it will end up in the Ninth Circuit.
And
there's no doubt we will win. They have violated the National Environmental Policy Act and a whole bunch of other things, partly because of this issue. The people that are making the decisions aren't necessarily people that would know all the
They laws. Never expected it. They never expected to have to. Thank you so much for that, Jody. My guest has been Coos Bay anti-LNG activist Jody McCaffrey. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Pacific Fishery Management Council says Oregon's commercial fishermen will be allowed to catch Chinook salmon all along the Oregon coast for the first time in 2 years. The fishing from May to September will be limited because of concerns about poor Chinook returns to the Sacramento River recently. Sacramento Falls Chinook provide most of Oregon's ocean catch. As for coho, declining returns mean they're off the commercial menu except in limited areas. The Fishery Management Council is offering better options than the last couple of years for a salmon industry that saw its largest closures ever in 2008 and 2009. But neither the council nor any other agency has seriously planned for the long-term survival of salmon.
No, it's always in these short phases, depending on which way the political winds are blowing. Well, all you have to do is slip the words green or sustainable into a corporate moniker and you're, well, gold. That's a Seneca Sustainable Energy's idea. Anyway, the company plans to fire up a power plant that will convert about 700 tons a day of logging so-called leftovers. Well, you don't get logging leftovers unless you have logging. So this is not exactly a sustainable idea right up front. But the company will also release more carbon dioxide and lung-damaging particulates than a comparable coal-fired power plant. Get that. It's sustainable. It's using 700 tons of logging so-called leftovers, and it pollutes more than a coal-fired power plant. Joining us this morning to talk more about this is Tim Hermack with the Native Forest Council. Tim, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're quite welcome.
How can Seneca call itself sustainable? Where does that come from?
They lie.
Talk about this plant that they're planning. They're expecting to see, and here's the real kicker. This company is expecting to receive millions of dollars in Oregon tax credits and qualify to meet the state's renewable power goals. How can it be renewable when you have to have logging in order to have logging leftovers?
It's not. The timber industry realized 15 years ago that they were going to run out of trees and that the kinds of fiber that they were growing on their industrial farms weren't going to be suitable for paper making or construction. And they came up with this idea, like I said, a long time ago, and they have been bribing politicians and paying PR firms to tout this green alternative energy production concept. And it is a totally bogus lie. Never in the history of the human race have we ever cut down a forest and regrown a like kind or better forest. Just go look at the once forested Middle East. Just look at the pictures on our website of industry's obscene report card. The destruction is enormous. They have the most destructive industry on the planet, destroying the lungs of the earth globally. In our country, over 95%. Teddy Roosevelt called them liars, cheats, and thieves. But unfortunately, they have spread the money around, and they have even bought gangrene. Many of what we think of as environmental groups are supporting more logging for these bogus reasons: viewshed enhancement, fuels reduction, fire risk management, and now the biggest lie of all, green alternative renewable energy. It's one-third as efficient, it's twice as polluting, and it's a million times more destructive to the continuation of life on Earth.
And we're giving them a tax break, too. Tim, that's all we've got. We've got Trey Arrow here in the studio today. Thank you so much for that. As always, I want to talk more about biomass and why it is such a terrible idea. It is very interesting to me that this has been a story in the Oregonian recently.
Amen. If you look at the follow the money, you'll understand why all of Oregon's timber Democrats are nothing but lapdogs for timber billionaires.
You don't have to scratch very deep. Thanks so much. My guest has been Tim Hermack with the Native Forest Council.
Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Doris Granny D. Haddock died peacefully Tuesday, March 9th, in her Dublin, New Hampshire family home. She was 100 years old. Granny D. walked across the United States at the age of 90 in a successful effort to promote the passage of the McCain-Feingold Campaign Finance Reform Act. And now look what the Supreme Court's done. Corporate personhood enshrined in American law. During the past 5 years, Granny D has traveled the country speaking about campaign finance reform and working for publicly funded elections in New Hampshire. There will be a public memorial service this summer.
And there will be KBOO memorial service right now. We're going to celebrate the spirit of Granny D. My guest this morning, our guest this morning on Cascadia is Trey Arrow, back on this Friday and hopefully future Fridays to come to spread the word through music and the life and the movement. Good morning. Thanks so much, Trey. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What have you got for us?
Well, I was going to play a little tune. I know we don't have too much time, and I, you know, in honor of Granny D and all the folks that are making some kind of sacrifice. This song is called Sacrifice.
Oh, let me just say that probably no one, very few people, have made the kind of sacrifice that Trey Arrow has made for his beliefs, which are beliefs that we all share, but may not have the courage to put our lives on the line.
With devastation and despair, feeling the rape and pillage everywhere, taking a stand with the pain we all share. Just give me a piece of injustice and sacrifice and blood spill freely. She gives of her life a strength and it needs so willingly. And life may be gone, but standing strong is responsibility. And one can learn a great deal from this great casualty.
Thank you so much. That was just beautiful.
You're welcome.
We have just a very few moments left. Just tell us a little bit about the inspiration for that song for you.
Well, it's amazing how universal I find music to be, and you know, people that even speak different languages can be moved by a melody and by music. And this song is written out at Eagle Creek when I was part of the defense out there with CFA and helping to protect Eagle Creek. And you know, and as I was singing, I realized like some of the lyrics, like, you know, directly relate to Granny D and life moving on, and inspiration from those that have, you know, carried a certain element of light and inspiration for us all. And today I'm going to be down, you know, folks may know that City Repair is doing this great month-long, I like to call it the Abolition of Apathy. And you can check it out on cityrepair.org and then go to the events section. Today they're having a social isolation workshop as well as a build your own cool fort workshop. The social isolation workshop starts at 4:00. I'm going to be there as part of that, I don't like calling it a workshop, play shop, teaching, Skillshare. And so we're going to be sharing some stories and some music and, you know, kind of talking about like feelings around isolation, social isolation, and different emotions that come up within activism and how we can build stronger communities. And so yeah, I'll be down there at 625 Northwest Everett. That's at the Sea Change Gallery. So everybody come on down. It's free and open to the public. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Thanks so much, Trey. My guest has been Trey Arrow.
This has been Air Cascadia for Friday, March 12th, 2010. Engineering is Todd Wilson. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You've been hearing news and comment and music from Air Cascadia on KBOO, your community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO.fm on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
And now stay tuned for Flashpoints with Dennis Burns, or rather Nora Barrows Friedman, talks to the 10-year-old boy who was arrested, beaten, and imprisoned by Israeli security forces.
Thanks for listening, thanks for your support, and have a good day.
Today on Flashpoints, senior producer Nora Barrows Friedman reports from the Israeli-occupied West Bank of Palestine. Nora will speak with a traumatized 10-year-old, arrested twice by Israeli soldiers and beaten so badly he was hospitalized. We'll hear from the troubled child, his family. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Nora Barrows Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now, I would love and am honored to introduce the work of Nora Barrows Friedman, live on the West Bank, Occupied Palestine, reporting for Flashpoints. Listen to this.
In the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the impact of Israeli policies on the children of occupied Palestine. Today, we take a look at the story of three boys, two young brothers from Hebron and one teenager from Dehesha refugee camp, who have experienced arrest, detention, imprisonment, interrogation, and beatings at the hands of Israeli soldiers. On Sunday, February 28th, Amir and Hassan Motahseb, 10 and 12 years old, were on their way to a relative's house in the old city of Hebron. They were playing in the street when two Israeli soldiers captured them and handcuffed them and threw them in the back of two separate jeeps. Hassan, the 12-year-old, was brought to an interrogation room at nearby Kiryat Arba settlement colony, blindfolded and shackled for hours before being transferred to Ofer prison near Ramallah, where he would stay for 7 days before being released last Sunday, March 7th, when the Israeli military judge in court admitted holding Hassan in prison was against the law. On the condition of his release, Hassan still has to appear in court at a later and undetermined date. While Hassan was being transferred to Ofer prison, his little brother Amir was detained at the settlement colony for 10 hours, blindfolded and handcuffed to a chair. I sat down with him on Thursday, March 3rd, at his house in Hebron. We begin with Amir's voice, translated by Shadi Al-Assi.
He said, we were, me and my brother, we were going to my aunt's house, and in our way there were two soldiers. They just stopped us and they told us, come here, we want to talk with you. And they arrested us, they captured our hands, and they put me in a jeep and my brother in another jeep. Then they took me to this school, Osama school. They were, he told in the beginning, I saw a lot of settlers and a lot of soldiers. They were there. They put me in a corner, and they bring a dog, and they put it next to me. And he asked them if he would like to go home, and they said no, you will stay here forever. And he said I would like to use the bathroom, and also they refused. And he stayed there from 8, like he was captured, and they covered his eyes in the end. And he was from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till he don't know exactly, like 10:30, his father, he come and he take him.
What was going through your head? Were you very, very afraid that they would keep you for long? What did you need at that point?
قاعد اليهود المستوطنين وفي نفس الوقت حطوا كانت تحت ال شو اسمه تحت النقطة وأنا قاعد.
He said the first thing comes to my mind is how to go home, how to run away and go home, and I was so afraid. Especially because they put just the dog next to me, and every time he was shouting at me, so I was really afraid. But the first thing comes to my mind, it's my family and how I gonna how I will run away and go to my place, to my house.
Afterwards, are you able to sleep? Are you able to eat? Do you feel okay?
He says like till now, like I had some problems. I don't sleep. I don't sleep well, and I feel so afraid. And I ask him, what's your favorite food? He don't mean the potato.
Did they hurt you? Did they attack you or beat you? What happened in those 7-10 hours that you were gone?
لا بس أنا بس غموا لي عيناي وظلتني قاعد على الكرسي
He said like they arrested me, they put me in a chair, they capture my hands and they cover my eyes, and most of the time like they didn't beat me in a direct way, but they used to say bad words to me, and every time I say something they said shut up, don't do anything, just shut up, you know, and they bring him water and he refused to drink. He was offered to drink their water.
What was it like coming back home when you saw your father? Who came to get you finally? What? How did you feel?
عادي. هي كنت خايف أول.
لا عندما شفت أبوك شنت شعملت هيك.
شو عملت وش كيف حسيت
يعني؟ المشاعر إني فلت من بين إيديهم.
He said, in the beginning, the first time I saw him, I was so afraid. I thought there was something big gonna happen. But the moment I left from there, I was so happy because, like, I ran away from their hands, you know? So I was so happy.
Amir, what do you want to do when you grow up?
Doctor.
Doctor? He would like to be a doctor. And special doctor who make the...
On the heart?
Yeah.
Yeah, heart surgeon.
Yeah.
He wants to be a heart surgeon. What do you want to say to the children of America?
I want to shed them and ask them to look at Palestine and see how they do it. معاملة سيئة.
إحنا أطفال حقنا.
وإحنا برضو أطفال حقنا إننا نلعب ونروح نجي.
He would like to tell them. He would like to tell them like we are kids like you. We have the right to play, to move freely, to feel like you. Nothing more than this. At the same time, to tell them, so I would like to tell them how the Israelis and how they treat us. Why we are kids, we are like 10 years, 9 years, 12 years, we can find kids 7 years inside the Israeli jails now, you know. And all what we want from you is just to look at us and try to help us to reach our freedom and to reach the freedom of movement, the freedom of playing, you know, like you.
That was 10-year-old Amir Motahseb speaking last Thursday. Amir's mother, Mukarram, had this to say about Amir and Hassan's treatment.
إلا منا يعني احكوا إنه اليهود أخذوا الجيش أخذوا الأولاد يعني كيف يعني إيه مدت تتقبل إن اثنين لسه صغار يعني الاثنين قاصرين يعني حتى أطفال كمان يعني هذا عمره 10 سنين وهداك لسه يعني ما جاوزت 13 ونص لحسان واخدوهم يعني
said, like the first woman she got the news she was really afraid of for the kids and as like any mother you know there are kids you know like if there are adults it would be okay but there are kids and they don't know how to handle their problems and when she knew that Al-Amir he's in this school the you know it's in a school an Arab school that's raised the occupied and there's a lot of settlers in there so she said I was afraid not from like from the soldiers but I was afraid more from the settlers themselves because there's a lot of settlers in there and I was afraid about the kid the moment I saw him like till now like he couldn't sleep sometimes in the night he can't go to the school he refused to go to the school he's so afraid so all these things affect me so much like I really feel so bad for them and for what's happened with them and about Al-Hassan like the one who's still in the jail like as any mother like she had a kid he's like between 12 and a half to 13 years old nothing more than this So I can't imagine like a kid like this, he will be in the jail. He has to live and to with old people, with adults, and you know. So it's not easy for me to understand what's going on with the kids, what's happened with Amir, and what's going to happen with Hassan. I can't imagine my kid. He's waking up at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, for like he stand in line just to be sure that he's there, you know. So I don't know how he can handle it inside the Israeli jails.
This is a story that's very common, unfortunately. And people in the States, in the United States, they don't know about this story. It's kept very much underneath the headlines. If you could speak directly to the people of the United States who pay the tax dollars to fund the Israeli occupation and the military that does this kind of thing to children, to your children, what would you say to them?
يعني بالنسبة للعايشين في أوروبا وأمريكا هيك بينظروا كيف أطفال فلسطين أول يعني كيف تعملهم.
What I would like to say is not to stop paying taxes. No, continue paying taxes for the Israelis. But you have to know about what's going on here, and after that, you will stop by your own. I'm not going to tell you to stop. Like these kids, the Israelis, they dealt with them as tourists. And for the Israelis now, it's to kill the new generation. It's better for them to, more than to kill the old people, because they see them, they see the future in the kid, in the eyes of these kids. All what they did, that they refused this occupation, all what these two kids did, that they carry a stone and they try to resist against the jeeps and the tanks and all these things, nothing more, you know. They refuse to be under an occupation, and the Israelis died, they consider them as tourists, people who would like they dealt with them in the same way how they deal with fighters, with people who carry guns. The other kids, he's like 9 years 10 years, and the other one, he's 12 years, nothing more than this. So even if they throw stones at the Israelis, what's going to happen? Nothing, you know? So all what she wanted is just to look at the Palestinian kids and to try to help the Palestinian kids to go out of this situation. She say like, Al-Amir now, he refused to go to the school. He's afraid from going out of the house. If anything happened around, he refused to go out because he's like, this time they arrest him for 10 hours. Maybe next time they will kill him. You don't know. So all what she wants is just to care and to watch what's going on here, nothing more than this. Yeah, she say like in the court, one of the lawyers, she's an Israeli lawyer, her name is Leah, that she was there not because of Hassan, she went to help other people, other adult people. But when she saw the kid, she take all the papers from her bag and was searching for something. Then she found the red balloon, and she gave it for him, and he started to play with it. And in that moment, the judge, he was really shy from like what he's doing. You know, a kid, he's sitting in just inside the fence, and
they put them in a cage.
Yeah, like a small cage, and he don't know what to do. So he was trying to hide his face from the cameras and from the people, you know. So even one of the lawyers, he asked Hassan, he told him, when you want to go home, you know, just to encourage him to be brave enough and something like this. He told him, you know, I was thinking about going back yesterday, but I don't know the way to go to Hebron, so I need someone to come and pick me from here, you know. So that's just to show you how even the way of the thing, this kid, he think, you know, just the small dreams, you know, just he would like to go back home, nothing more than this, you know. He dream about the house, you know, like, I don't know the way to go back to the house. That's all his problem.
How are you preparing for Hassan to come back, and how are you dealing with Amir's trauma right now?
بالنسبة للحسن يعني إن شاء الله بيروح أول إشي يوم الأحد, بس إنه لو إنهم يعني اليهود ما بدها
She hope he will go home on Sunday. And but even if that doesn't happen, that if he stay in the jail, she hope when he will be released, he will go out of the jail as a man, like a young man, 14 years old, a young man, you know. But that's what the Israelis want, you know. If they want to release him, they could release him from the moment he was here. But they want him. They want to create fredness inside this kid, so don't do anything in the future. against the Israeli occupation. And she's sure, like, if he's staying in the jail, that means that the Israelis, they want him to be in the future someone who works against this occupation. You know, like a kid, he's 13 years old, he's in the jail, he saw all these things around him. Of course, in the future, he will not go out of the jail and he will become a peacemaker. You know, he will be something completely different. He will know and he will try to resist against this occupation. He will know that this occupation and this, these Israeli police and these Israeli government did something wrong for him when he was a kid. So in the future, I think he will be something completely different. He will try, I hope he will try to resist and he will try to refuse this occupation. And she hope he will go home on Sunday, you know, and they're going to have a party here.
And Amir, you know, what are you afraid of in the next coming days and weeks and months and years?
قبل ما ياخدوا الولد كان أجرأ من هيك ما يخافش من اليهود. هلا لما اخذوا اليهود وحجزوا له 10 ساعات عندهم صار عنده يعني عامل
شي ساي like a lot of things happened, a lot of big changes happened between before they arrested him and now. Like before, he used to go out, he used to play a lot in the street, and you know, he used to go to school by his own, and he never ever think about like he never ever been afraid before. For him now it's like very hard, and she hopes like in the future, in the soon future, he will become normal again, because it affects him a lot, like psychology, the psychologist way, healthy, everything, you know. Like he don't eat that much, he don't sleep well, he don't go out, he refuses to go to the school alone. Every time he's waiting, he asks the family if there is internationals who would like to, who will come here to talk with him, so they can take him home or not, you know, or to take, they can take him to the school. So she hope everything will be fine in the soon future, and she hope he will return back as he used to be before. She say like he used to make fun a lot before. He used to joke and to, he was so active. Now most of the time he's just sitting watching TV. He don't go outside of the house. He refused to go out.
Hours after that interview last week, Israeli soldiers broke into the family's home around 2 o'clock in the morning. They took Amir from his bed, prevented his father and mother from protecting him as the soldiers assaulted and threatened them with their weapons. The Israeli soldiers took Amir downstairs under the stairwell and beat him brutally until he bled into his abdomen. Amir's parents rushed him to the hospital where he stayed overnight receiving emergency treatment. Amir wouldn't speak for another day and a half, exhibiting symptoms of excessive trauma and shock. Today, Amir is back home with his brother and family, but will most likely need a lifetime of mental health services. Abed Jamal, a researcher at Defense for Children International's Hebron office, talks about the role of the international community in terms of holding Israel accountable for its violations of international law, especially against Palestinian children.
They say, of course, the, like to arrest a kid, it affects the family so much in different levels. Like it affects the family, the brothers, the sisters, the father, you know. But in the same time, according to the history that we have, you know, since a long time, we are used to these things, you know, to have a lot of people inside the jails. Like in the first Intifada, for example, a lot of Palestinians, each family, they had someone inside the jail. In the same time, like it became like a routine. It became part of our life to have a kid he's inside the jail, or to have someone from a family he's inside the jail. But that doesn't mean that we don't feel or we don't. It's right that we are used to it, but at the same time, it's hurt so much. It affects the family in a different ways. So. Even now, they try to work with the families and they try to support the families, because, in general, all the Palestinians, to be honest, all the Palestinians, they need the psychological support. They need, you know, because of the things that they saw in their life and with the way how the Israelis are trying to treat them.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're here in Hebron in the occupied West Bank, and we're at Defense for Children International. Can you talk about the legal proceedings? You know, you have attorneys working pro bono for free to defend these children and their families. Have you seen any successes? Have any Israeli soldiers or commanders gone to jail over the treatment that they have meted out against children, and because this is all illegal under international law, including the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child. Has anybody been prosecuted because of their violations of this?
So he said most of the time we can't talk about big things we achieve through our work because first of all the most of the lawyers are volunteers and they are trying to do their best to struggle against this Israeli military courts. And he said, like, most of the time, like, we are trying to use the law. That's the only weapons that we can use against such kind of these things that Israel use against our kids and against the Palestinians in general. So the only thing we can use is the Geneva Convention, the Children Convention, Childhood Rights Convention, the United Nations laws. But most of the time, the Israelis, they come and they say, that's a military court, you know. So all the laws in the world, if they say it's a military court, that all the laws doesn't exist anymore. So he say, we are trying to reach something, but the problem is, they give us this excuse every time. And in the reality, like, we are doing, but at the same time we are not doing, you know. That's how it is now.
So the only recourse would be to have the international community and the United Nations actually step in and take these kinds of legal measures against Israeli commanders themselves because of the violations of international law.
Exactly. That's it. Exactly. He said, of course, that's something important to work with the international community, and now it's the only solution in front of us to do something in this case, it's the international community. So what we are trying to do, what we have to do is to, as Palestinians, we have to work all together to create a big kind of solidarity in this case. Not only in the childhood or the children's rights case, in general as Palestinians. So through our work, we are trying to reach the international community, we are trying to tell about what's going on here, about different cases in Palestine, to create a kind of support for this. And we believe that the only way to reach an end for what's going on here is the international community, because they are the one who could do something against this occupation. No, they never had international lawyers. Most of the time, it's Palestinian lawyers who live inside Israel and who hold Israeli IDs, because even the Palestinian lawyers inside the West Bank are not allowed to be in military courts or the courts that are not for the Israelis. According to the Israeli law, there is nothing called Palestine, so they don't they are not exist anymore. So they use Palestinian lawyers who live inside the Green Line, like from 48, Arabs from 48, or from Jerusalem.
Can you give me some statistics, finally? How many children right now are in jail, and what is the youngest child in jail right now?
He said, like, from the beginning of the Second Intifada till today, like, the number itself, we can't tell about the number, it's expanding, and sometimes it's changeable,
yeah.
We say. So sometimes it's 1,000, sometimes it's 2,000, it depends. And all from the 2,000 till today, there is a lot of thousands of kids that were inside the Israeli jails. Right now, in these days, they had 350 kids inside the Israeli jails. They are separated in different places in Israel. And they are having a very bad situation inside the jail. Some of them, they are under administration detention. Some of them, they are already went to the courts and they are judged already inside the Israeli jails.
And how old are these kids? Give us a sense of how old they are.
Most of them are in between 14 and 18 years old. Like the majority, she said, the majority is 18 between 14 years old and 18 years old. Yeah, I know a kid. He's in the jail. He's, I think, 1 year and a half. even this الطفل هذا اللي أمه ودته في السجن أصغر
he was born in jail yeah.
yeah he was born in jail and he stay in the jail till now he say according to the international law the age for the kids is like till 18 years old in Israel it's 16 years old and this is also against the international law in the same time there is a special law inside Israel it's called 132 it's allow the Israeli army to arrest kids who is more than 12 who reached 12 years old you know so in this way they had a legal cover for what they are doing
في الاعتقال الأخير أو الطفلين اللي سألتين عنهم قبل شوي حسن
he say in the last case you asked about for about these two kids even sometimes they are breaking their laws itself like we are talking about 132 which it is they are allowed to arrest kids from 12 years old but in the last case they arrest a kid he was born in 1999 and they arrest him for a few hours and a few hours for a kid in this age that means a lot you know so even the Israelis the laws inside Israel it's changeable so anytime they could change this law anytime there's no law inside Israel at all
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman you're listening to a special report on Palestinian children brutalized under Israeli military policy here on Flashpoints we now go to Dehesha refugee camp in southern Bethlehem where 17-year-old Mohamed Lakhmour was taken last year by Israeli soldiers in the middle of the night detained, interrogated, and sent to prison for nearly a whole year.
My name is Mohamed Lakhmour, and I'm 17 years old.
My name is Mohamed Lakhmour, and I am 17 years old now.
Okay, tell me about what you were doing the day that you were arrested.
فش يعني طبيعة الإشي يعني أنا كنت نايم وكنت ما كنتش عارف من اللي ماخذوني يعني متأكد 100%.
So he say when they come to arrest him, he was sleeping at home. The soldiers they come to the house and they enter to his flat first, and they destroy everything here. Then they went to the second flat in the top, and his mother she wake him up. She told them the soldiers are just in front of the house, and he told her like maybe they come to look for me. So they enter to the house. They ask about him, and he say I'm Muhammad. They couldn't believe that he's Muhammad because he was very young in that time and he was short. So they didn't believe that he's the same person that they are looking for. And in the end, like they arrested him from the house and they took him to the stairs just in front of the house.
بعدين يوم حكيت نال مهند وهيك بعد ما صدقوه حكوا لي دخلون.
So he say after that, like they didn't believe in the beginning that I'm Muhammad. Then after I proved that I'm the guy that they're looking for, they told me go inside, wear something because we want to take you for half an hour, 1 hour maximum, and we'll send you back here. So when he went to inside to change his clothes, they fight with his brother Mustafa, and they beated Mustafa in the room where he was. And after that, they took Muhammad and they went down. They didn't let him say goodbye for his family. And when he went down, he say, "I would like to see my grandmother," and they refused to let him see her. And they beat him in that moment when he refused to go with them out unless he see his grandmother. Then they start beating him and they forced him to go with them.
بعد ما خذوني بعد ما نزلت تحت وصارت مشكلة أجى الضابط صار يحكي ما حداش يصيبه وهيك وطلعني ومشيت لعند الجيب.
After that, like the captain or the leader for the army, he came and he asked, he stopped them from beating him. And they asked him to walk till they reached the cars. There were two cars, so the soldiers they went with him in the same car, and the leader for the army he went in the other car. So they take it as an opportunity, so they can beat him because, like the leader of them, he's not in the car. So they were beating him all the way from here to Abbas Asyon Adu, all the way from here to Gush Atzion. It's a military camp next to Bethlehem. They were beating him all the way from here till he reached there. It's around like 30 minutes from here, half an hour. That he say like when they were beating him, he was captured. Like they put something in plastic in his hand and his eyes was covered, so he didn't know who was beating him or like he couldn't defend himself because he can't see the soldiers.
What were they saying to you as they were beating you?
إنهم يضربوا فيا كانوا يغلطوا يعني بكوا يعني بكوا يسبسبوا يعني حكي مش منيح يعني سب وهذا.
Yeah, they said like most of the time they were saying bad words to him about the family, about his father, his mother, about him, himself, and they told him you were trying to improve, that you are a man and you are an adult, so you will pay a lot for that. And they say that you are a terrorist, you are someone who destroy, who is working against the Israeli state.
Okay, so then you got to Gush Etzion, and then they took you to Muscovie prison in Jerusalem, which is a very infamous detention center where people are tortured frequently before they're usually moved on to another prison or jail. Talk about what that was like.
أول ما دون على أسيون سووا لي فحص طبي اللي بيشمل كل شيء بعد ما خلصنا ودونا على المسكوبية.
He say like first when he goes to Gush Etzion they make a health check for him, everything, you know, to be sure that he's okay, he's fine, there's no health problems with him. Then they transfer him from Gush Etzion في نفس اليوم. In the same day they transfer him from there to Muscovia. The moment he entered Al Muscovia, they take him to they start to ask him questions about what he did and what he's doing these days, what's his name, his everything, you know. And they were forcing him to say things that he did, some things he didn't do it, you know. They use a lot of different ways. They say he says they were beating him. They use like individual rooms, small rooms. They put him alone for a week. They use different styles, you know, to force him to say things that he didn't do. So for Kadesh, 39 days he was alone. Every 1 week or 2 days, 3 days, one soldier he come, he pick him, ask him questions, take him a lot of through a lot of stages, then send him back to the room for 39 days.
What was going through your head as this was all happening? What were you thinking about? Were you able to sleep? Were you eating at all? What was going on?
بعد زي ما حكيتنا أول أسبوع يعني كنت متعود إن تعبت فيه أول أسبوع.
He said like the first week was so bad for me, like most of the time I was thinking about my mother, my family, my friends, what's gonna happen to me, how much I will stay in the jail, all these questions comes to my mind altogether. That was in the first week, but after that I start to deal with it as it's something normal and I have to stay for more time, so I have to deal with it, I have to solve this problem. So I stopped thinking like strongly about it and I start to deal with the situation as it is. They told him a lot that we're gonna release you in the court and something like this. So he didn't even believe them, and he still think that even if I go to the court, I have to prepare myself for being here for more time. So that was the worst and the hardest time for him, the first week and you know the first 39 days. It was so hard for him to deal with it and to understand what's going on.
بعد ما صار الحكي هذا بالنسبة للأكل الأكل كانوا يجيبوا لنا يعني أشياء مش منيحة يعني يدوا علينا
نحن. So he say like about the food, like they used to bring them very bad quality food, like just you know just to eat, you know, just to live, to serve. And sometimes, a lot of times, they used to bring them a lot of expired things, you know, with expired dates. And he said, like, we were under the ground, and the jail itself is under the ground, so we didn't know if it's morning or night. We don't know what's the time or anything. And after that, they start to take us for, like, 10-20 minutes outside in a square. But wherever you look, there's fence. You know, so even with the fence, it was the best moment for us. This 20 minutes was the best thing for us because at least you can smell normal air, you can see the sun, you know. But even with that, still affect us a lot, you know.
After 5 weeks in Muscovia prison, where did they take you?
بعد ما خلص من المسكوبية صار ودوا فينا على محاكم يعني أول إشي في المسكوبية صار ودونا المحاكم داخل المسكوبية.
He say they used to make the court in the same jail. So a lot of times like it's like administration detention, we call it. Like 10 days, they give him 10 days. After the 10 days finish, he go to the court in the jail itself and they renew it for him. After that, when they finish in Muscovia, they transfer him to Ofar. It's near Ramallah. It's one of the only, I think, now it's the only Israeli jail inside the West Bank, and it's next to Ramallah.
يوم وصلت أوفر يوم ودون على أوفر هناك انبسطت يعني ما كانش في بالي الترويح أنا خلاص إنه بديش أروح
لأنه he said when they transferred him to Ofar he was so happy and that even if it's a jail but it's still better than Muscovia because at least he saw a lot of people from the Haitian refugee camp he know them there that he said like the people the Palestinians inside the jail they take care of us and because I was so young and they helped me a lot they bring me dresses they bring me they used to help me with the food with everything and that was the best and he prepared himself for more long term you know so he thought he because he, they transfer him from a small jail to a big jail he thought he will be like 2 or 3 years in the jail so but when he saw the people around him he started to feel better than when he was in Al-Muscovia
and this was still under what they call administrative detention so you weren't charged you weren't convicted you didn't have a trial this was all just done internally within the Israeli military court system. Yeah.
يعني ممكن نسكت بي أجن محامي ويعني رفع دعوى على ال على المحقق.
So he say like when he was in Muscovia they were only this court under the administration detention nothing more than this and in the end when the his lawyer came and he make a big problem for the soldiers because he spent like 39 days without trial without anything so they transfer him to Ofar and after that they come again from Ofar and they send him back to Muscovia
really back to Muscovia
yes
قديش المرة الثانية قعدت في المسكوبية
بعد بسبوعين ودونا على أوفر بعد بسبوعين يعني كمان 39 يوم واحنا قاعدين
so they send him to Ofar they send him to Muscovia for another 2 weeks and after that they say even you can't get involved in this story and you can't go to the court again against us because there is a big story and we have to take more time in
the process
yeah in the process and they forced him to stop, like, from going to the court.
Mohamed's mother, Yusra, had this to say about the impact that this kind of brutality has had on the entire family and the community within the camp and across occupied Palestine.
He said,
like, in the future, like, it will be acceptable for her if one of her kids, he will be in the jail, for example, in the future. Because even till now we still have an occupation. Till now we had a lot of things happening on the ground, and every day things going worse and worse. So maybe in the future there will be more things or more actions. Like for example, she said like the youngest brother for Muhammad, he's like قديش عمره أصغر واحد 13. She's 13 years old, and she don't know. Maybe after 2 years they will come and they will call him to go to the Israeli security and you know or they will come and capture him she don't know what will happen
Muhammad the same يعني مش بعيد كمان اذا بدهم يعاودوا ياخذوا او ينسجن ايش ما بستبعده هذا انا لانه نفس الاوضاع
قاعد she say even Muhammad maybe they will come and take him again like it's right that he would like to study he would like to go to the university he would like to make his life better but like in the same time the situation and what's going on around him it's like good reasons you know to do something against the occupation to be in jail again you know because of the situation itself
you know and the final question maybe how hard is it as a mother and you see you know there are 12,000 people in this camp and there are, you know half of them are children how hard is it to watch these children be born and you know be part of this community and one by one watch them be put in jail for something as arbitrary as throwing a stone. What do you think as a parent, as a mother, as someone who's part of this community about that?
أنا بشعر زي يعني أنا زي أي أم بتستشهد لها ولد أو بتصوب لها ولد أو بنسجن لها ولد كمان لأنه هذا وضع على الكل مش على واحد.
She said, like, in the end, we are all the same. Like, we are suffering from the same thing, which is the Israelis. And like, if I have a kid, he's in jail. There's another mother in the camp. She had a kid who was killed by the Israelis, or he was also in jail. So even like every family here inside this refugee camp has their own story. And they had their own suffering. They had their own way of suffering. But that doesn't mean like we have to cry and to be sad because of these things. No, even like she say, like when a kid got killed by the Israelis, or when a kid be in jail for a year or 1 year and a half, that gives the people the opportunity to struggle more against this occupation, to don't let something such kind of these things happen again. So it make us stronger. It make us. Let us think more about the future and these kids. We share together, it's right. But in the end, we have each one. He has his own problems and his own afflictions from the occupation. She say like Muhammad before that he was in jail. He was shot by the Israelis. He was injured, and Mustafa, his brother, the same story. You know, so even before the jail, they were shot, and two times Mustafa he was shot. She say, like we pass through all different kinds of punishments against us. We pass through being shot, being killed, you know. And even if it's not your kid, for example, she will be like the kid of your sister or the kid of your daughter, or you know. So we pass through all the suffering, and that's what makes us stronger. And he adds something else. He say like, even like these kids, when they do anything against the occupation or when they resist against this occupation, doesn't come from nothing, from the space. No. For example, he say like, me, my other two brothers, that we were in jail.
Four
brothers, they were in jail. Three from the same family. Like two, his two uncles and one of his brothers, they were killed by the Israelis before, and they are martyrs. So it's not easy for them, you know. Like to just to live normal, because there's a lot of stories happened before and there's a lot of things happened before, so it's not easy for the new generations to live normal. He say, when I used to go to visit Muhammad, I used to see my friends who were with me in the jail. They come to visit their sons, you know. So it's the same story, like from a generation after a generation. It's like in a historical conflict. It's not like a new conflict. Like from generation, even the conflicts from a generation to a new generation. It's like this.
For Flashpoints, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, reporting from Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.